Welcome, everybody, to Advice for Life, Lesson 2. So I'd like to just kind of set the stage a little bit for today's class. We are all here at different ages and stages of life, little children, bigger children, no children, pre-children, post-children. When we talk about the family, surely the notion of family when we're beginning a family and building a family is the primary focus of the effort, the investment that we make into family. But it doesn't end when the children grow up. My father often tells me that parent is always a parent, right? So your kids grow up and they still need input, and the sanctity and the investment in the family unit continues really throughout life. Additionally, sometimes families don't get it right when they start out, and oftentimes when there's friction and fragmentation in the family, people throw up their hands and say, oh, I messed up, or someone else messed up, and you know, there's no hope here. The fact is that there's always hope, and as we're going to present today the Rebbe's unique perspective about the family, because the perspective is as we're going to present, that means that no matter where we are in that journey, no matter how things play out, there's always room and there's always a need and a responsibility to invest in the family. Now, what is family? Sure, family in the conventional sense is mom, dad, you know, son, daughter, that environment. But family is my relationship with my parents, my relationship with my siblings, my relationship with my children, my relationship with my spouse. That all makes up family. So just because somebody doesn't have the picture-perfect structure of family, it doesn't mean that the investment in family is out the window. Again, if, as we're going to present, we take the Rebbe's perspective, all of this quote-unquote family is where we ought to be investing ourselves. Now, we use the word investment, and the reason we use the word investment is one of the classic metaphors of really anything important in life is a tree, right? The Torah says, "Ki ha'adam eitz hasadah," for man is the tree of the field. The concept of a tree is not a by chance metaphor, but it's very specific. We plant the seed needs nourishment, it needs nutrients, it grows slowly, it requires greater attention in the earlier years. And what is the objective of the tree? To produce fruit. Fruit means both children, but also, as our sages say, that the fruit of the righteous are the good deeds. So good, healthy relationships produce good offspring, both God willing, children and grandchildren and so on, but it also produces people who function in society and are contributors to society. They make a difference in the world. They do good in the world. They're a mensch. They're a good example, and within the Jewish people, they're a good member of the Jewish people and so on. So the concept of a tree requiring nourishment, water, sunlight, we take that metaphor to what we need to invest into creating healthy families, and obviously it's not water and sunlight, but it's comparable investment. So let's pose a question, which you can find on page 30 in your student book. What are the attitudes, behaviors, and values that sustain and fortify a harmony within a family? In other words, if a tree needs water and sunlight and nutrients, what are the things that a family needs? What are some attitudes that are important for a family? Anybody?
Love, respect.
Love, respect, great. Anybody else?
I like the word good.
Okay, tell me more. Good attitudes, you say? Good attitudes, great.
Kindness,
great.
Communication,
beautiful. And what are some behaviors that nourish family?
Say please and thank you.
Good, polite, good manners, Rituals, good.
Cooking,
so acts of kindness, right? Acts of love, making time.
Honesty,
very good. Great. So all of these are vital in what's necessary for a healthy family. Today we're going to delve into the Rebbe's guidance for families. And what we learned from this is that even though the Rebbe's advice often were for families that were in crisis, the advice is applicable surely in advance of the crisis and to prevent the crisis, right? If there's a crisis and we have advice to get out of the crisis, surely if we apply that advice before we get into the crisis, we help minimize the crisis. We'll use a parallel of health, right? When somebody, oftentimes, unfortunately, it's when the person has their heart attack that they go to the doctor and they start taking care of their heart, right? You don't have to wait until you have a heart attack before you start taking care of your heart, right? We can take care of our heart and prevent a heart attack. If the resolution of a familial conflict is good communication, compassion, love, acts of kindness, and so on, surely we can incorporate these things before it becomes a crisis. And this is reflected in the following text, text one. Let's start today from the left here. Dan, would you read for us text one on page 31?
I received some information about the relationship at home, but I do not know to what extent it reflects the actual situation. Hence, I want to convey to you some thoughts in the light of what the relationship should be, according to Shulchan Aruch, Jewish practical guide to life. If the relationship is indeed in keeping with it, the purpose of this letter will be to strengthen and deepen it, as there's always room for improvement in all matters of goodness and holiness. Nor in this case. On the other hand, if it is not quite what it should be, I trust that since the Torah is surely a lamp unto your feet, you will bring it up to the desired level, and you will do it with joy and gladness of heart.
So let's remember, as we presented last time, and we'll continue to find this theme flowing through all of the classes, that the Rebbe's perspective is that the material and the spiritual are two sides of one coin. They come from each other. So if you want to have a healthy material life in whatever its manifestation is, work, physical well-being, emotional well-being, or family life, the investment is on the spiritual side of things. And as the Rebbe reflects in this letter, if there's a crisis, great, the Torah is there to give guidance. And if there's not a crisis, all the more so the Torah is there to give guidance. In other words, if the Torah is light, it sheds light when there's a problem, and it also sheds light when there's not a problem. There's a joke that's told of a couple who needed to see a therapist. Happens. So they came to this elderly woman who's been a therapist for many years, and the therapist turns to the husband and she says, "No, so what do you have to say?" So he just looks at the floor, doesn't answer her. She waits half a minute, he doesn't respond. So she turns to the wife and she says, "No, what's going on?" And she starts launching into this whole thing. "My husband, he doesn't help. He doesn't clean up around the house, doesn't help with the kids." And she's going on for a half hour and complaining about all this stuff. So after a half hour, the therapist walks behind the woman's chair and gives her a big hug. And then she turns to the husband and she says, "What your wife needs is what we just did here." So he thinks for a moment, he says, "That's great. Can I drop her off every Monday and Wednesday?" So the actions that we want to take at home, the goal is to prevent the crisis. And the Torah has the wisdom and the guidance and the light to help us through. So let's look a little bit at what is the problem. Now, there is the natural challenge that exists in all families, right? Years ago, the used to be called Yeshiva Atlanta, had a now it's called Atlanta Jewish Academy, had a fellow who's not so popular these days, Bill Cosby. He did a show at the old Atlanta Civic Center. It was a fundraiser for the school, and we were invited. And he did happen to say a couple of good jokes. One of the things he said is that the dysfunction of families is not a modern invention. He says, you go back to the Bible, go back to the very beginning of the Bible, right? And you have Adam and Eve and Cain and Abel. There's dysfunction right from the very beginning. So we're not dealing with new dysfunctions in 2024. But the world is constantly changing. And what's important for us to identify is what are the contributing factors that we're experiencing in the world that create a different scenario, a different challenge for families today than they were in the past. So let's see what the Rebbe says about families and how families show up in contemporary society. And would you read for us text 2, please?
One of the elements for any nation, especially is the preservation of the family unit. Unfortunately, this institution has been utterly neglected. The focus on the family unit is lacking somewhat or significantly, even with those who generally try to follow a Torah lifestyle. They set aside time for Torah, study, fulfillment spoke meticulously, and even act with some sacrifice to influence Jews who are spiritually disengaged. Yes, the father, mother, and children are walking a single path, the path of Torah and its hope. Nevertheless, they do not walk this path as a family. You readily observe the critical, regrettable effects of the father, mother, sons, and daughters living in religious states of worlds.
So what's interesting about this letter is that the Rebbe is talking clearly about, as well, an observant family, right? So being observant doesn't get you off the hook. You still got to deal with the realities of the world around you because we're influenced by that. Some people try to keep the world's influence out, but today we know that that's almost impossible. So we have to really identify that just because we may be observing the mitzvot and we may be studying Torah, it doesn't exempt us from the influence of what's going on around us. And we have to pay attention to it and identify it in order for us to see how the Torah helps us navigate those very challenges. So what are some adverse outcomes when there's a lack of family unity? So we've got loneliness when there's a lack of emotional support, right? A family is supposed to be the place where we draw emotional support. And when there's a lack of emotional support, we feel alone in the world. I remember my father-in-law often tells us we were a family of a lot of girls, Athena's side of the family. There's a lot of, most of the grandchildren are female. We have a few token boys here and there, but it's like ratio 2.5 to 1. So he says, if you're not going to be your daughter's friend, she's going to go find someone else to be a friend. I'm talking to the dads, right? You dads, you need to be your daughter's friend or they're going to go find friends somewhere else. And not necessarily the best of friends out there. So why is that? Because a child is, and this is true for female children as well, and male children, that the family is where they get their emotional support, ideally. And if they're not going to get it there, they're going to find it somewhere else because they're lonely. And everybody wants to get rid of that loneliness, that uncomfortable feeling of loneliness. And we find different ways of doing it, and we're going to, which is not a healthy outcome. So we all ideally should find that within the family unit. The second thing is conflict. When there's a lack of communication, which was mentioned earlier, or trust, which was also, or honesty that was mentioned earlier, right? So what begins to happen is we begin to break down. The family unit begins to break down. We don't trust each other. We begin to suspect the other. In addition to that, we can have resentment that is born out of that. And there's a competitive nature that gets involved, and that competitive nature can flow every which direction between children and parents, parents and children, parents amongst themselves, children amongst themselves, right? So when we have this unhealthy, this lack of unity within the family, there's all kinds of breakdowns that happen. And then we have the newest contribution, which is what's going on in society today. So here's three things that we want to focus on with the following introduction. And I'm going to say it multiple times so we don't hear it not as it's intended. There's no judgment of, at least not in what I'm about to share or in the intention of this, of these societal factors. In fact, there's a lot of positive in all of that. But we have to know what we're dealing with. So the first thing that we have is that the world has shifted. And by the way, I will tell you that the Rebbe nurtured this shift within a Jewish framework as well. We've shifted away from the community to the individual. Once upon a time, everybody did what their parents did. You belonged to the same synagogue, you paid the same dues, you just followed in line, you fell in line. And as the world has evolved, this notion of, wait, I don't need to do what my parents did just because I did. I'm also an individual, and I get to make my own choices. Okay, great. Make good choices. Okay? If you make good choices, it's great that you're an individual. If you're making bad choices, well, that's a risk of individuality, individualism that is born from that. But as we're going to talk at the end of today's class, there's something very powerful about the individual. But we do have a shift in how people see themselves today. So even within the family unit, you have individuals who see themselves as individuals. They don't see necessarily the family unit as their primary. Number two, we have technology, right? Wow, that's a hard one, right? It's pervasive. And again, technology is such a powerful tool. There's so much good that's come out of technology. But it's also extremely damaging and extremely distracting, right? You sit down, you're talking to someone, and they're in a different world. You're sitting in the same room. You're within 2 feet of them, but they're an entirely different planet. And what planet are they in? They're completely torn up. I'm sorry? Planet Google. You know, but even within themselves, they're competing with someone they don't even know. They see some image on Facebook or something on Instagram, and suddenly they need that other car and that other house and that other emotional system, and it's completely consuming. Again, it's an extremely powerful tool. So much good has come out of this technology, but at the same time, it's extremely distracting. I mean, imagine once upon a time you were able to sit down at a dinner table, and the greatest violation of the dinner table would be if you pull out a book, right? How many kids are showing up with their phone? I gotta tell you, you know, even at home, it's like the teenagers, it's constant competition. When do I get my phone? You're not getting a phone until you go away from home, right? But that's competition. Like that creates fragmentation. It creates a challenge anyway within the home environment that the children want this thing that's going to then distract them. So you're suddenly battling a whole world of technology, right? Here's another one that's touched upon here that I think is important. It's a little delicate. And again, there's a lot of positivity to it, and many of you in this room are part of that revolution, and that is the role of the mother. The role of mom used to be take care of the kids, stay at home, nurture the environment of the home, make sure the home was safe and the kids were taken care of and the house was put together and so on. And we moved away from that in big part, where there's a world where women are career-oriented, and again, it's great, it's wonderful, it has a lot of positivity to it, but it does create a challenge. And we have to look at all of these challenges of individualism, the challenge of technology, and the nature of the roles of parents in the home, and see how we are supposed to navigate. When I do premarital counseling, I always ask the couple, I say, well, how do you see your role as a husband or as a wife? And I say, I'm not here to judge it. I don't have a personal preference in relation to your marriage, how you see yourselves. I just want you to know how you each see each other so that you can approach the realities of life, right? If you are both working people and you see equal responsibility, that's fine, but understand that one day, God willing, there'll be children that also need equal responsibility. And make sure you know what you're getting into and you're committed to that. And you're going to talk about that so that the children aren't neglected. Right? So that we don't say, well, both of us are career-oriented and the children are going to fall by the wayside. That's not healthy. You're not going to produce healthy children. You're not going to have a healthy family unit. So again, it's important for us to be talking about these things, to recognize what are the challenges. And again, regardless of the nature of the relationship that we're talking about, whether it's little children, whether it's a relationship between adults and their siblings or adults and their parents, all of these scenarios require, we're all victim. We may not be, you know, 15 years old, but we're all victim to some of these influences. The notion of individualism, the notion of technology, we're all victims of that. You're trying to build a relationship with your 50-year-old brother or sister or your 60-year-old brother or sister. There's a technological factor involved in that, positive and negative, right? You can use Zoom and FaceTime and all these things to connect with a sibling that you may not see, but, you know, on rare occasion. But on the other hand, the technology is also a feeder for notions and perspectives that people have. So we have to recognize all of that in how we navigate these relationships. So what is the Rebbe's perspective of the family? So I'm going to show the first of four videos. And in this video, the Rebbe talks about the priority of children and family and how that ultimately translates down into healthier people and more successful and more effective.
Rabbi Yitzhak Meir Gurari is mashpia of the Lubavitcher Yeshiva in Montreal. His father, Rabbi Zalman Gurari, was a devoted chassid and a financial supporter of the Rebbe's work.
At a certain time, it was a lot of Yutes. My father did business in overseas with big, rich people. Lashak, who was in charge of the yeshiva, asked my father that when he goes over there, he should take him along, introduce him to those people, should pay to raise money for the yeshiva. My father says, okay, I'll do it on one condition. If you get the Rebbe to promise me that if we're successful, he'll give me a bracha for whatever I ask for. So he went to the Rebbe, and the Rebbe said, okay, I did deal. He went to them, and they were very successful. But they came back, so my father told Rashad, don't get, so he went to the Rebbe, and the Rebbe said, okay, tell him to come in. Came in, so he asked the Rebbe, what do you want? So the Rebbe asked him, what do you want? I told him, what do you want? My father then had a problem, big business problem. So I'm proud of myself. What? He needed a nest. He wanted to have my brother, that he should be have this nest. So the Rebbe said, you have a chance to always bet and answer with the wills. The Eshte Zach Batman, I'm the Lord Nachas for Kinder. And the Kinder is on Zion, for the Kinder is on Eishmach, so the same that I'm going to. So my father says, I was like, better than us. I said, okay, they can come. I don't know if he asked, gave a bracha for the business deal, then I don't know. But my father repeated this very often. I do remember sometimes, I don't know if it's transcribed, but I have such a memory, recollection, that the Rebbe once, Rav Abrahamian, mentioned that the Nusach HaBrocha, Bon Achayim Zoyne Revicha, that he uses. The Rebbe uses very often a bracha, Bon Achayim Zoyne Revicha. So this with a diuk dafki, because Bonne, nachas for children, is much more important than even gesund. And parnasa is the third.
And Rebbeson loved the Rebbe with all her heart. I mean, the Rebbe loved the Rebbe. Rebbeson of all his heart, he always showed great concern for her. He was always telling me, please go after this visit immediately to the Rebbeson to reassure her that things are okay, because she's always so worried. And vice versa, the Rebbeson just had such a great admiration and respect for her. For her, the Rebbe cherished his private tea party with the Rebbe, and the Rebbe said that he equates the importance of the tea party with his wife on a daily basis with the necessity to put on film.
That's my ears.
You put
on my ears. That's my ears. That's my director en Suisse. Alors, on fait des
all is good partners. I'm very glad.
Let's turn to text 3 for a moment. Very interesting note on a verse in the Torah. So this is at the beginning of the fourth book of the Torah, the book of Bamidbar, the book of Numbers, so-called because the opening of the book is God's instruction to count the Jewish people. And in the second verse, the Torah says, count the congregation of Israel according to their families, to the houses of their fathers. So we know that the count of the Jewish people was 603,550. God is counting the Jewish people. He knows the number. But the Torah specifically emphasizes that the count needs to be according to the family, because the nature of the individual is nurtured when there's a focus on family. It's the family unit that brings that quality out. Text 4 on page 35, in here we see again a teaching from the Rebbe that brings home the relationship between the importance, the holiness of the family unit. And then we're going to kind of unpack this concept in a moment. So, Murray, would you read text 4?
The Torah's mystical teachings strongly emphasize the importance of the family unit. The minimum requirement to fulfill the mitzvah to be fruitful and multiply is to give birth to a son and a daughter. Kabbalah and Chassidut explain that this is hinted at in the name of Hashem, spelled with the letters Yud and He, followed by Vav and He. The Yud corresponds to the father, the first He to the mother. The Vav alludes to the male child, and the final He to the daughter. A family with all four elements, father, mother, daughter, and son, is a complete representation of the divine unit. It follows then that just as the four letters of the divine name, when inscribed together as a word, become a unique entity, Hashem's personal name, so the individuals of a family are fundamentally transformed into a new existence when they become a family unit.
So let's focus for a minute, look on the image on page 36. So what we have here is a very powerful relationship between God's name and the family unit. Let's qualify the family unit for a minute. We can't really, although the genetics are evolving, so we maybe at one point we'll be able to put a coin in the machine and say that I want a boy, I want a girl, and so on. But we're not 100% there yet. But as a concept, the Torah, the mitzvah that the Torah gives us at the beginning. Of the very beginning of the Torah, to be fruitful and multiply, which is the obligation, the commandment to have a family, to fulfill that obligation in its most technical form, one is required to have a male child and a female child. That's the mitzvah. Now, you end up with two boys or two girls or one boy or one girl, whatever it is, however it ends up, all power to you. But this is the model picture, so to speak, from the Torah's instruction. This model is contained within the name of the divine, within Hashem's name. How so? So the Yud, we'll do two quick run-throughs because it's a much deeper conversation, but the Yud is masculine, He is feminine. Vav is masculine, He is feminine. So you've got father, mother, son, daughter. That's one notion. The other notion is Yud is Chachma, the burst of the conception of an idea, which is the contributing factor that a father gives. Hey, feminine, Bina, is the gestation of an idea. And again, physically, it's where a child gestates between before birth. Vav represents the manifestation. It's a conquering. It's a masculine energy where the nature of men is to conquer. And Hey, the physical letter of Vav, is a moving forward, it's a drawing down kind of energy. And the hay is an expansive energy, which is a nurturing energy. So the hay is like a nest where the feminine energy, which nurtures and nourishes. Regardless of the specific nuance, we see that within the divine name, we have the notion of the family unit. So when the family unit is intact, the divine name is intact. Which means that in the family unit, we have the divine manifestation. Now, what does this mean? So let's dig in a little bit deeper. If you'd like, you can join me and Dina April 1st through 7th on a trip to Israel. If you've been to Israel and you've stood at the Western Wall, you've stood here and you've looked up at this wall, and there's a certain powerful awe that overcomes you. And if we can imagine going back 2,000 years and you're walking up to the temple for one of the major festivals together with thousands of Jews, you come to the Temple Mount, you come to the place of the temple, you see the awesomeness of that experience, one can recognize that there's nothing seemingly holier than that experience. There's the greatest manifestation of God on this earth. And yet, if we look at the Torah's instruction regarding the construction of the Mishkan, the construction of the tabernacle, and subsequently the construction of the temple, there's a very different message that's conveyed about where the greatest manifestation of the divine is expressed. Mars, would you read for us text 5 on page 37?
Sure, sure. In communicating his directive to build a holy temple, Hashem stated, "Build for me a temple, and I will dwell within it." Our sages note that the anomaly, the verse says, within them, Jewish people, instead of within it, the temple. This informs us that Hashem wishes to dwell not only in his temple, but also within each other. In truth, Hashem dwelling within us is not a secondary objective, but the primary objective of his directive.
Is correct.
Hashem's primary home for the temple, the Torah should have stated clearly, where Hashem would reside within it, while at the same time finding a way to him. The concept that Hashem also dwells within us. Instead, the reverse is the case. The Torah states openly, "I will dwell in them," indicating that this is the primary objective. The opening of the verse, "Build for me a temple," is simply the method by which the primary goal dwelling within the Jewish people can be achieved. Where is the physical location of Hashem dwelling among us? In a home where father, mother, sister, and brother form a cohesive family unit.
Make for me a sanctuary, and I will dwell within them. What is the Torah telling us? Make a beautiful sanctuary. I want you to make me a holy temple. And if you do that effectively, causing my presence to dwell, it will translate down into them. I will dwell within them. In other words, if you visit the temple, and I would say the temple, and any temple, and any synagogue, and any holy environment, and any Jewish engagement, and if you do it effectively, which is to make it a sanctuary for God, the result is that within them, within the expanded family unit, the divine light is going to be expressed.
Is the family considered a temple?
You're considered a temple. In other words, the Torah's instruction is make for me a sanctuary and I will dwell within them. Within each and every individual who makes for themselves a sanctuary, that's where the presence of God is manifest. Where that gets most expressed is Yes, as we mentioned last time, it's expressed in the workplace. But it's also expressed in the family unit. And because the family unit is so powerful, the Torah is basically saying is, yes, I want you to build this magnificent edifice in Jerusalem. But if you're successful in this edifice and what it represents, there's going to be holiness in you. And there's going to be holiness in the family. And that holiness is going to continue to expand and impact the world and promulgate the generations from one generation to another. So yes, it's not exclusive to the family, but it is very powerfully expressed in the family as the Rebbe understood the messaging of that verse. And because this is the method through which God wants to ultimately, right? We don't have the temple in our history of 5,784 years. We've had the temple a total of 830 years. So we've had a lot more years without a temple than with a temple. What's the point? And the last time we had a temple was close to 2,000 years ago. So what's the point? The point is that the temple is a metaphor. It's also literal, but it's a metaphor for bringing godliness into the world. As we discussed last night, the whole objective of creation is to make the world a dwelling place for God, a home for God. In other words, finding godliness in the material world. And as we said also, the greater the opportunity, the greater the challenge, which is why family life is challenging, because there's such an opportunity for godly light there. It's not to be looked at as a negative. It's a demonstration that there's something very powerful here. You don't pick off diamonds off the top of the floor. You got to dig for them. You got to polish them. The greater the return, the greater the investment. You want a really nice tree, it takes time. You got to get your hands dirty, and you got to water it, and you got so on and so forth. In the following video, the Rebbe makes the point that raising children perhaps is the key to fulfilling this obligation or this mission of making the world a dwelling place for God.
In 1970, Rabbi Nosson Gerari and his wife set out on Shlichus, establishing the Chabad Student Center at State University of New York, Buffalo.
In the first year after I was already in Buffalo, I went in with my late wife to the Rebbe, and the Rebbe gave tremendous brachas. Among the things that he said was that there should be a Dira B'Tachtonim in the city of Buffalo and all the communities around. But the Rebbe ended with his holy words that the Nekuda HaPnimius from Alts, which means all the things that he blessed till now, the Nekuda HaPnimius von Alts is Chesedus Nachas for the Kinder. Which means that the Rebbe made it very clear that the most important thing, he said already, Dir B'Tachtonim, you would think, what could come after that? He specifically said, but the Nekuda HaPnimius von Alts is Chesedus Nachas for the Kinder.
So, yes, please.
Where is it first written, this phrase, to make a home for Hashem in the earth? Is that from the Tanya? Where?
So it's actually brought down in the Medrash.
Okay.
Medrash says, Nisava HaKadosh Baruch Hu, that God desired Leah Slay is Baruch Dir B'Tachtonim to have a dwelling place for his blessed presence. I'll tell you a cute story on that question. So there was a rabbi in Cleveland, was not a chassid, an open antagonist of the Rebbe, especially in the earlier years of the Rebbe's leadership. There were a lot of Jewish leaders that didn't appreciate the Rebbe's approach. So there was a rabbi from Australia, his name was Rabbi Chaim Gudnick of blessed memory, who was in the United States, and he was going to Cleveland for a family simcha. And he had an audience with the Rebbe before he went. And the Rebbe asked him, he said, when you're in Cleveland, do me a favor and go visit this rabbi and try to find out what his bone is with me. Like, what's going on? Like, what did I ever do to him? I mean, I'm putting the emotion into that. Find out what his issue is. So he says, okay. And then the Rebbe said, come back and report to me. So he goes to Cleveland and he meets with this guy and he tells him, this rabbi, and he says that the Rebbe asked me to find out what the issue is. So he says, I have two issues with the Rebbe. He said, number one, the Rebbe took an obscure medrash, this medrash, where it says that God desired to have a dwelling place in this world, and made it the whole focus of Judaism. Everything in Judaism is about making this world a home for God. It's an obscure medrash. That's issue number one. Issue number two, he says, is every time the Rebbe comes out with a mitzvah campaign, he doesn't consult with other Jewish leaders. He says, we're going to promote tefillin now. We're promoting mezuzahs now. He doesn't, I'm a Jewish leader. Why doesn't he consult with me before he begins these mitzvah campaigns? So he said, okay, I hear your complaints. I'll go take it to the Rebbe. So Rabbi Gutnik comes back to the Rebbe and he presents what this rabbi had said. The Rebbe smiled and he said, he answered his second question with his first question. Somebody who doesn't see the whole focus of Judaism being about making the world a dwelling place for God, I can't consult with a person like that. We're not on the same page. So the reality is that this was the Rebbe's worldview. And I actually just wrote about it in my weekly email, is that the Rebbe shifted. It's not the Rebbe's novel idea. First of all, it comes from the Medrash, right? It's not the Rebbe's novel idea. It's the Rebbe's record, and the Baal Shem Tov was very outspoken about this. And the Baal Shem Tov also, it's not the Baal Shem Tov's novel ideas. These are our Torah traditions. What's shifted is where is our focus? Once upon a time, we lived in a world where the best we could do is make sure we survived the day. You know, that the shtetl was protected from a pogrom. We didn't live in the world. We couldn't live in the world. But in the last couple of hundred years, as the world has become modernized and we now, Jews now live in the bigger world, we're engaged in the world. Now the time has come for us to actually bring this to its fruition. We are living in the world, so we can't say we're living in the world, but we're going to hide from the world. That defeats the whole purpose that the world has evolved to where it is. Our job is to make a dwelling place in the world. So maybe even in the context of our conversation here, once upon a time, the family unit, the human beings in the family always needed love and nurture. But maybe it was adequate that you got up in the morning and you went to the cheder and you did what you were told and you lived your life. We live in a different world today. The world's got all the challenges it has. And we have to be more conscious of that. And now the opportunity to make the family unit into something that's shining with a beautiful divine light, that's something that's new. Not novel, not original, but now that's the calling of the moment. Right? Work, maybe, as we discussed in last class, maybe our occupations were just a means to an end in the past, not because that was the truth of them, but because that's what all that was available. Today, you can be in the world, you can work, and you can have tremendous influence on those around you. So things have shifted, and therefore, because the world has shifted, the pnimiut, the inner dimension of our purpose on this earth, has risen to the surface. So let's see, how does the world look at the Western world look at the family unit? So fundamentally, it looks at the family unit as, what can I gain? What can I get out of this environment, right? Again, it's born out of the individualism. It's born out of the influence of others. Everybody trying to, the dog-eat-dog world, everybody wants to get to the top and get the most for themselves. So when it comes to the family, the notion is, what am I getting out of this? And the only, and when I evaluate that and I say, wow, it takes so much to be a member of this family and the results are so little, I'm not sure I'm into that. Torah's view is that the family unit is not, it's not there to serve you. The question isn't, what has my family done for me today? If the question is, what has my family done for me today, then I do make that evaluation. I put effort in and I'm not getting enough out of it. Let me find a new job. Find a new family, which is a line we use with our kids sometimes. They don't love it. right? Well, that family has this and that family. You want to go move into them? You can go at any time. We're happy to give you. No, not really. But when the question is, what can I do for my family? When we see the family as a place where we're making a mikdash, we're making a sanctuary for God, this is the environment where we have the opportunity to make it holy. Then the question is, what am I doing for the family? What have I done for the family today? By the way, think about this as it relates to teenagers, right? As teenagers begin to develop their own individuality more, right? And there's this big transition that teenagers go through to move from the self-centeredness, which is the nature of the human being as a child, right? We come into the world with our fists closed and demanding feeding and diaper changing and whatever else is on our mind. And then we go into this notion where mom and dad are constantly taking care of us. And then at some point, when the kid turns 9, 10, we start talking about you actually have to take into consideration the other human beings in your environment and that the whole world doesn't revolve around you. But teenagers are going through that transition of recognizing that they're not here just for themselves. And as they move through that transition, they're faced with a pretty serious challenge. And that is, what is the family doing for me? You ever hear the expression, I'm sure you've seen this on the movies and the TV, it's like, I don't need this, right? I don't need this. What does it mean, I don't need this? Why does a child tell a parent, I don't need this? I don't need your guidance. I don't need your lectures. I don't need the responsibility. Why? Because the child is in that mindset where you're here to serve me. If I'm not getting what I need out of this environment, then I don't need this. But that's not really the question. It's not, I don't need this. It's, what am I needed for? And this is such a powerful shift that the Rebbe oftentimes in various different interactions had with people who were struggling with various different things. The Rebbe tried to empower them so that they moved out of a self-centeredness. A lot of people, we're going to talk about this at length in the discussion around emotional anxiety and so on, that when we're preoccupied with self, we're going to have anxiety. And when we move from a place of me, 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 to say, I have something to do here, I have a responsibility here, I have the ability to make an impact, we stop thinking about ourselves so much. So when we see the family unit as this environment where we have the ability to bring holiness into the environment, that shifts our thinking and our responsibility to that environment. So this perspective of the Rebbe's we find in much of the Rebbe's correspondence, the Rebbe's guidance. Let's look at text 6 and 7, where this message is brought home. Gabriella, will you read for us? Text 6 on page 38.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Yes.
I trust it is unnecessary to emphasize to you at length that the Jewish way of life, together with its customs, etc., is not only very significant in general, but also in every detail and in the very order of things. In light of this, it becomes obvious how important our peace and harmony between husband and wife, since the mitzvah of making peace between a husband and wife is counted among the mitzvah whose fruit a Jew enjoys in this world, while the capital remains for the world to come. These are mentioned right at the beginning of the Siddur, together with the morning blessings, which are said even before starting the actual morning prayers.
Yep.
With this approach in mind, it will prove somewhat easier to understand that even if one party were to be completely in the right, or almost completely in the right, while the other party was completely in the wrong, or almost completely in the wrong, it would still be incumbent upon both parties to do everything in their power to restore peace and harmony. As to the situation itself, namely, who is right and who is wrong, I cannot, of course, go into this, nor is it necessary in light of what has been said above. For the important thing, as already stated, is to strengthen the family ties, this being the overriding consideration. However, it would be well if you could find a mutual friend before whom both of you could unburden yourselves in a frank exchange of grievance. It is possible that an outsider, who at the same time is a friend, might see more objectively and find the best way to straighten things out and in the soonest possible time, so that once again peace and harmony may reign in the home.
Thank you. Answer, would you read text 7, please?
Our Torah teaches us that as water reflects a face, so does one heart respond to another. I see from your letter that you're willing to do everything that depends on you that there should be shalom bias, peace, and harmony in your home. And as a practical businessman, you are surely implementing this in actual practice. I am therefore confident that the above quotation from the Torah will be fulfilled also in the present case. I want to take advantage of this opportunity, since you've written to me, to emphasize again the enormous importance of shalom bias, so much so that our Torah, called Torah MS, because it presents the truth, declares that when a husband and wife are worthy, the Shekinah divine presence abides among them. Obviously, every effort is worthwhile to ensure God's presence in the home, and with all of that, it means in terms of his blessings, materially and spiritually. Hence, even when one thinks that one is 100% right, it pays to conciliate for the sake of peace and especially for the sake of the abiding Shekinah as above. There is also the assurance of our sages in such matters. Try hard, and you will succeed.
It's really interesting, if you look at these letters, is that the Rebbe is very compassionate, very empathetic for the struggle. He doesn't dismiss the struggle, but he also shifts the conversation away from the struggle. In other words, you want to get into a conversation about who's right and who's wrong, that fight never ends. If that's what defines the tension in the relationship, if that's what it's defined by, there's always going to be the next issue down the line, that there's going to be a right and wrong, and you're always going to be battling. It needs to be addressed. Go find someone who knows both of you, and they'll help you figure it out, they'll help you navigate. A good therapist doesn't get into the boxing ring with the couple to say, like, we're going to determine who's, you know, who, I'm going to be a referee today to decide who's right and wrong. That unfortunately ends up in a court, and that's when the judge decides who's right and wrong, and that's not a pleasant ending to that situation. If the focus is on what is this relationship about, what are we really about, what connects us to each other, why are we connected to each other, what is our purpose here, what is our objective here? When that's where the focus is, recognizing that we have an opportunity in this relationship to navigate the tensions in marriage in order to succeed at bringing godly light into this environment, into this home, into this family, that shifts the whole nature of you and me and our conflicts and our debates. And again, it's not that they're not going to be there, but our focus is not going to be on being right and wrong, but how do we figure out, how do we create harmony between us? How do we recognize our differences and find how we can meld them together? How can we be respectful of each other instead of it being an ego trip and a constant battle of egos? Again, the result of the focus of family life being this opportunity to bring holiness and sanctity into this environment changes how we look at the struggle. And this is the Torah's perspective. So let's shift the conversation, now that we've gotten some understanding of what the Rebbe's perspective, what Torah's perspective is in relation to the family unit, the importance of the family unit, the sanctity of the family unit. Let's talk about some practical suggestions on how to make this happen. So let's begin with text 8. You have to read, Doctor? Text 8 on page 42.
One solution for this challenge is to emphasize something that is already important for other reasons. Efforts should be made to ensure that all family members come together, beginning with Friday evening, and especially on Friday night, when the Shabbat meal is served. Parents and children should gather in the same room, around the same table, engaging in conversations fitting for Shabbat. On Shabbat, it's easier for the family to unite because family members aren't engaged in their weekday endeavors. When the family nurtures this unity on Shabbat, it will experience unity throughout the week. The factor that unifies them, cultivated during the Shabbat meal, will prevail over their differing focus areas so that their differences only complement each other. Achieving such unity within the family is not likely to occur spontaneously because the importance of the family unit has been overlooked for several years. We must acknowledge that this area demands dedicated attention and effort. Fortunately, the Talmud, Megillah 6b, assures us that diligent work will yield positive results.
Thank you. So, Shabbat. Shabbat table, what's beautiful about the Shabbat table is that we're compelled to spend quality time together, something that's not necessarily common in our society today, right? How many families back in the day, the image of dad coming home from work and food being put down in front of him and the family gathering around and having dinner, right? That's in the black and white movies, or the ones that depict, you know, something from the 30s or the 40s. And every Friday night, we sit around the Shabbat table. Okay, so just the connection that's taking place there. Number two, what are we talking about? So in its purest form, the code of Jewish law, the Shulchan Aruch, prohibits us from talking about mundane things. So we're not talking politics. We're not talking about, you know, the latest gossip, the latest news. We're talking about things that are meaningful. We're talking about the Torah portion, right? We're talking about ideas that creates connection. Because all of that other stuff is on the surface. And then, because on Shabbat we don't use technology, we don't have the technological distractions that are there. Now, as we're going to touch upon in a moment, we may not be in a position or in a mindset to embrace all of this picture, right? One of the things that I've discovered since October 7th, which I was not that aware of before, because I'm not an Israeli and I haven't spent that much time in Israel, is that Friday nights in Israel, religious and secular Jews gather around the table. Now, for many of them, it's not necessarily your traditional Shabbat meal with Kiddush and Challah and Torah discussions, but it is the practice across the country that people get together for a Shabbat dinner. It may be just dinner on Friday night, but it's part of the culture, it's part of the tradition that lives in Israel today. That's a very powerful thing. Yes, it may not have all of the other features, but it has that core feature that families getting together. And if you're not in a position to get rid of the technology altogether, encourage the people sitting around the table to put away the phones for an hour during the meal. And perhaps the conversation, which I do this often in my house, I do have an apolitical opinion, not an apolitical opinion, but a political opinion. I'm not that passionate about politics, but inevitably, on occasion, somebody mentions something political at the table, and the other person wants to engage in the conversation, and I have a policy that I've always said, we don't talk politics at the Shabbat table. I generally don't talk politics with anybody, because it defeats the mission that I'm here to accomplish, which is to spread Judaism, and politics are such a dividing thing, especially these days. We don't talk politics at the Shabbos table, and we try to facilitate the conversation, bring an idea from the parsha, and put a question on the table. It's amazing how enjoyable, it doesn't even have to be like a deep conversation about all the various different commentators. Bring an idea from the Shabbat, from the Parsha, you can look it up on Chabad.org, and pose a question for the human experience. And just let that conversation go, right? We're getting out of our own personal protectors. We're getting into a conversation about ideas, things that are really binding and connect us to each other. So it doesn't have to be an everything or nothing kind of structure in order for us to make that happen. Now, in exercise 2.3 on page 43, we have the basic format for how we get out of being stuck in life, right? This is not unique to this particular mission, but it's true with anything in life. If you're stuck in your life in anything, there's something that you want to get done, follow this assignment, and you will be able to break out of it. But let's just talk about it in the context of the Shabbat table. Here are some tangible actions I can introduce to my routine to enhance my family life. What are some things that you can do to enhance your family life? And again, as we said, whether you're talking about building a stronger connection to your brother or sister, stronger connection to your children, stronger connection to your parents, stronger connection to the entire family unit. What are some things you can do? And number two, why haven't you done them in the past? Or why haven't you done them consistently in the past? Identify what are the things that are preventing you from executing on these. And number three, these things will no longer be a problem because what are you going to do to make sure those things are not a problem? So let's kind of bring together what we've been discussing. The nature of family life is not so much, it's not only in the same vein, what can God do for me, but it's also what can I do for God? In other words, this is my job in this world, is to make the world a holy place. I'm here to serve God. Nurturing the family does that. And yes, it benefits me too. In other words, just as I'm going to invest in good practices that nurture the relationship, and I'm going to visit them on a regular basis. Am I offering enough gratitude to my spouse, to my sibling, to my child, to my parent? Am I connecting with them often enough? Am I making the phone call, right? If you don't call, you don't call your parent, you don't call your child that's grown up, the connection is going to go away. You can't say, oh, well, they haven't called me. I mean, you could say that, but that's where it's going to end. You want to stand on ceremony? Fine, that's your ego talking. But if you want to say, hey, what's my responsibility here? I have an opportunity to bring godliness into this environment. I'm going to pick up the phone and make that phone call. I'm going to make that effort to create that connection. We don't get stuck on our ego. So if we need to do those physical things on a regular basis to nurture that family connection, when we're driven by the focus that this is an opportunity for holiness, to making the world a godly place, for opportunity for us to connect with God, it becomes that much easier. Text 9, I'm going to read this one. This is a letter to a young couple that were about to get married. And the Rebbe says, I've learned with pleasure of your forthcoming marriage, and I send you my blessings. It's superfluous to underscore that from the moment of marriage, a new era begins in the life of the two persons who have united into one to build an eternal home among our people, Israel, into posterity. And as in the case of building a physical home, the important thing, even to those who otherwise attach much value to external appearances and superficialities, is the solid foundation upon which the entire edifice is to rest. So, and more so in the case of the spiritual home, the important and vital conditions are not to be found in superfluous aspects, but in the reliability and character for the material to withstand all sorts of tests and all kinds of weather. So yes, a home is important, and how your wall is papered, or what kind of carpet you have is important, but what's most important is what's underneath the house, what's the foundation. What I mean by the solid foundations of the Jewish home needs no elaboration to you. Throughout the ages, the Torah and mitzvahs have been solid foundations of our people and have given us courage and strength to endure the most terrible inhuman persecutions and tests to the limit of self-sacrifice and martyrdom. The power of self-sacrifice for Torah and mitzvahs has made us indestructible. It is my heartfelt wish to you, and I am confident of it, that you and your chosen one will together build your home from the start upon the solid foundations of Torah and mitzvahs with an unshakable determination to make your home Jewish in every way, in thought and in deed, thus assuring yourselves real happiness and Jewish happiness. So what happens here is you have this couple, we're asking the Rebbe for a blessing. You want a blessing? The Rebbe says, here's my blessing to you. My blessing is that if you want to have a wonderful marriage, if you want things to be great in that young love, when you have this fantasy of everything being awesome forever and ever, build a strong foundation. Build a strong foundation, which is a foundation that's built on Torah and mitzvahs, and this recognition that there's more than just me getting some needs fulfilled here, and you're going to have a long life together. And it translates down not only into the spiritual, but into all of the other dimensions that are necessary for a healthy human being. As we said in the first class, godly and the holy and the mundane, the material and the spiritual, are two sides of one coin. And this is true as it relates to the body. When there's peace between body and soul, it makes peace between spouses all the easier, right? Because what happens when we are focused on the other? What happens when we're invested in the relationship for the purpose of making godliness, the bringing the light of godliness into this environment? So yes, a relationship requires safety. A relationship has its needs. We want security. What's the best way to get those needs met? The best way to get those needs met is by showing up for the other person. The greatest way to show up for the other person is by not showing up with an agenda. When you show up to serve the other person, and how can you serve the other person? Because you see it as a godly mission. You see it as a holy objective. Then by default, you're going to get your needs met. Not only because they're going to respond in kind. As King Solomon says, that as man's reflection is reflected in the water, so too is one heart of man to the other. In other words, if I show up with a selflessness, you have to respond selflessly. Maybe not right away, but that's the way it works. That's the human nature. People meet emotion with emotion, right? But it's even deeper than that. Because why do I have my needs? Why do I have my need for connection, my need for love, my need for all this stuff? Because I'm preoccupied with myself. And it doesn't mean that the body doesn't have those needs. But if I stop dwelling on it and make my primary preoccupation in bringing the godliness into the environment, into your life, into the life of my sibling, my parent, my child, my spouse, my needs are diminished, which means that they're being met as well as they're actually being met, right? If we're looking for connection, the external connection is very superficial, but the internal connection is much more profound. So if I show up more internally, I'm going to get more internal response from you. So my deepest need for connection is actually going to be met. Now, there's, so we mentioned the Shabbos meal, Shabbos table is one of the points of connection, one of the mitzvahs that help bring this down. But if you look on page 46, we have seven other mitzvah campaigns that the Rebbe promoted. And these mitzvah campaigns are, we'll notice that they mostly focus on the individual and things that they, the action items that an individual takes. But it's the individual action items that affect the environment around them. So putting a mezuzah on the door is an act, it's a single act. But the result of that is it illuminates the home. Giving tzedakah is a single act, but the result of that, it makes the home an environment of giving. And so on and so forth. The next video is a little long. And I'd like to, I'm actually going to come back to it. I want to focus first on the last idea in this talk, in this class here. And then I'm going to come back to the video. So, first of all, any questions or comments on what we've been talking about? I've been doing a lot of talking, not so much listening. I always interpret that either I'm doing a great job or a terrible job.
I'm glad you say great job.
Thank you. I was looking for a compliment. Thank you.
You can come every Wednesday. I'll give you one.
Oh, thank you. okay. So Israel is in all of our minds. And in fact, much of what happened on October 7th was in the kibbutzim. So what's a kibbutz? A kibbutz was an invention of the early 1900s. Of the early Zionists who came to Israel, and they were influenced by the socialist mentality of the countries that they came from, and they conceptualized the idea of a kibbutz. And at its core, the kibbutz is a commune, multiple families living together. There's an equality; everybody takes the same salary, everybody lives the same way. Most of the modern kibbutzim don't actually operate with that same system. They're called kibbutzim because they carry the, because it's a closer, tight-knit community. They're very focused on agriculture. We went to Israel last year, and I believe it was in April, and we went to visit this kibbutz that they actually operate with much of the same principles, but they are producing, what's that big tractor, farm material?
John Deere.
John Deere. This kibbutz makes like over $2 billion a year. I mean, it's crazy, the kind of the stuff. They brought the Israeli chutzpah and ingenuity of technology, and they brought it and they're selling it around the world. They have some unique technology, how they wrap it, hay bales and stuff like that. And there's a, you know, there's 500-600 people that live on this kibbutz. It's a beautiful kibbutz. But the guy who runs the company gets the same salary as everybody else. So there's still some of that holdout, but there's very few kibbutzim left like that. The concept of the kibbutz is very romantic, right? It's a very romantic concept. Oh yeah, we're all equal, everybody gets along, and so on and so on and so forth. And it works to some extent, but it doesn't really work anymore in our modern world. And probably then a lot of the negatives, there are plenty of negatives that came out of it, but we're not here to criticize the kibbutz. There was an individual from the kibbutz, his name was Kaddish Luz, and he wrote a book about kibbutz life. At some point, he was the speaker of the Knesset, and he had a correspondence with the Rebbe, and he shared his book called Avnei Derech with the Rebbe about life on the kibbutz. And the Rebbe responded to his letter and focused on the tension that exists in kibbutz life. Susan, would you read for us 10a, please, on page 47.
Familial cohesion must not come at the cost of individuality. Care must be taken to avoid family members feeling neglected or underappreciated as individuals. In a letter penned to an Israeli government official, the Rebbe addressed this topic in the context of the Israeli kibbutz. He espoused the principle that groups must function as a platform for individual development. Accordingly, each child within the familial framework should have a distinctive stake in a home-based mitzvah. The Talmud notes.
Wait, you're reading 10a?
I started the wrong place.
Okay, come on, Maya, that's fine.
Okay, the Talmud notes that just as people's faces differ one from another, so do their minds. Therefore, individuals attain contentment and wholeness when they actualize their personal and unique potential in its fullest measure. This level of satisfaction is not found to the same extent when they engage in matters that they share in common with others. Instead, it is achieved through engaging in things they excel at and that set them apart from their companions and surroundings. This achievement allows them to express their essence. On the other hand, human nature is not to live in solitude. It is not good for the human to be alone. And it is our nature to seek social interactions that allow us to reach our completeness.
So how do we resolve this tension? Are we to focus on our needs as individuals, the things that make us unique? Or do we focus on the needs of community so that we're not preoccupied with self? This is the tension that the Rebbe is reflecting on what goes on in the kibbutz. In 10b, and I wanted you to read 10b, page 49, if you're okay reading here.
On the one hand, collective living is essential because it provides a structure to prepare people to share resources through which great things can be attained, greater even than some of the individual strength. On the other hand, collective living is not an end in itself. It is a preparatory stage to the development of each person's individuality and uniqueness, allowing it to be realized and advanced in the fullest measure. Often the idea of collective living arouses numerous and inner resistance against the order that seeks to subdue the individual's uniqueness and endeavors to transform the individual into the work of the law of God. If, however, people are informed that their collective living leads to personal development and maximizes their ability to reach even greater personal goals by freeing them from the worries of less important goals, because the group utilizes its increased capacity to provide for everyone's basic needs without wasting critical time and resources. It would not only neutralize their natural resistance, but increase their passion and commitment to their roles within the group.
Beautiful. So the reality is that both are true, both are necessary. We have to find the right balance between the two. The balance is that the community's objective is to nurture the individual. The individual is there to serve the community. And in serving the community as a unique individual, that's where our true satisfaction comes from. So there has to be the balance there. We have to see both as being true and both needing to feed each other. And the same thing is true in the family. There is the family unit as a single entity, but there's the individuals in the family. And as long as the individuals in the family are there to serve the family as an individual, we can find fulfillment there. But when the family becomes the objective exclusively, then we lose our identity as individuals, and we lose our drive to, and ultimately it's the human condition, so you're going to try to suppress that drive. It only will create conflict internally and subsequently externally as well. The Rebbe wanted the idea of Shabbat candles to be promulgated. Mom lights the candles and brings the light into the home, but there's the young girl at the age of 3, and even before the age of 3, who's encouraged to light candles as well as an individual, even though the light of the candles is for the home, but each female member of the home contributes to bringing that light in. Again, the same messaging is contained there. In text 11, on page 52, the Rebbe talks about every child making their own room, their own bedroom, right? Even though we're part of a home, making each individual's bedroom into a unique home, a unique blessing with a tzedakah box and a chumash and so on, making sure that there is, again, the individual expression in each room, even as that room is part of the totality of the home. So the messaging of today's class, I'm going to skip through the two videos, and then those that would like to stay are welcome to. Again, the Rebbe emphasized that each family member must have a part in creating the foundation of the home, even small children. So family bliss, how do we achieve this objective? The first is to understand that the Torah's concept of a family life fosters stability and unity. In other words, that there is the benefit of the Torah's perspective that gives the family its healthy structure. Number two, it's the Torah's values that create, that feed that, that nurture that. Number three, that there's the individual. When there's a focus on the individual, but the individual is not focused on themselves and their own fulfillment, but their contribution to the family as a whole, then the family as a whole is nurtured and it grows from there. Next week, we're going to talk about physical illness and treatment of physical illness in the Rebbe's perspective. As we mentioned in the first class, oftentimes people will turn to the Rebbe and ask for guidance on dealing with health matters. And the question we posed was why turning to a rabbi, a Hasidic Rebbe, to get guidance on health matters. And we're going to see how ultimately the same premise is there, that everything in the material is a reflection of the spiritual, and therefore a Rebbe has that perspective and the architecture around that. So one video is about 11 minutes, one's about 3 minutes. So those that would like to, how do we do this?
In the late 1970s, Charles Ramat had a number of audiences with the Rebbe. During one of these meetings, he asked the Rebbe about something he was struggling with.
I told the Rebbe, I'm having a crisis of faith. I really do not believe. I love Judaism. I love a lot of the rituals, but for me, they're nostalgic. How do I find true faith and true belief? And it's almost like we have philosophic discussions, but they were the things that were really bothering me more than should I invest in this property or should I invest in that property. And the Rebbe's responses were absolutely deep and incredible. And they were tailor-made to me. It wasn't a system that he said, you have to go into the system and you will be better. He really, I felt, was speaking to what would work for me. And he asked me, do you keep kashrut? And I said, no. Which, by the way, took a lot of guts to sit in front of the Rebbe and say that. There was actually a terrifying moment But, you know, my relationship was based on total honesty. How could you lie to the Rebbe? He says, do you put on tefillin every day? I said, no. He said, so I'm going to ask you to do one thing. If I ask you to do one thing without any precondition, will you do it? I said, yes. Anything you ask me, I promise you, I will do it. He says, will you and your wife agree to light Shabbat candles every Friday night while you're married? I said, done. And we weren't at that point. We have never missed in half a century lighting Shabbat candles. My children, when they grew up, even though they went to secular schools, Friday night and Shabbat, not the day of Shabbat, but Friday night was sacrosanct. Nobody went out. When my kids were teenagers, no parties. I had all kinds of business meetings, dinner invitations, you know, fun things to go do. Friday night is Shabbat, we're home. We never miss lighting the candles. And I would say that simple, simple mitzvah, which is one out of, you know, 500 that I'm not doing, has kept my family on a Jewish path throughout our lives.
Shmuel Abramson works in special education and lives in Muncie, New York. As a college student in the mid-1970s, he decided to reconnect to his Jewish heritage.
When I later transferred out of my school because I became interested in, you know, finding the right path, and at one time I was going to come to yeshiva in Kahais, and the last minute I backed out, I was confused, I didn't know what to do, I ended up going to Yeshiva University. It was there that I met my wife, and my wife had come from a modern Orthodox family, and we started seeing each other and growing together. When we eventually became engaged, we scheduled an appointment with the Rebbe. Now, I didn't know how it worked. I was told, put your name down on a piece of paper, put your mother's name down, that we're just going to give the Rebbe that, and the Rebbe's going to give us a blessing, that's it. But I didn't want to miss the opportunity. So, you know, some of the details I don't remember exactly, but I remember that I took two pieces of paper. And what I wrote, I figured that the goodbye and the secretary is going to collect one and give it to the Rebbe. But I wrote on another one, Rebbe, I'd like to ask you some questions. We came in, the Rebbe looked at me, the Rebbe looked at the piece of paper, and he said, you'd like to ask me some questions. And the two questions I asked the Rebbe, the first one, you have to realize again from where I came from and what I was grew up with, I asked the Rebbe, even though I had in mind more than I had in mind the drug experience of other drugs, but it was capsulized. I asked the Rebbe, I said, I have two questions. One, is marijuana a legitimate means to religious consciousness? Okay. And the second question was, I said, how do I and my kala achieve compatibility? I said these words. I said, my lifestyle in the past was beyond her wildest nightmares. And how do we achieve compatibility? So the Rebbe looked at me, and he said, are these your only two questions? And I said, yes. And he gave a big smile, looked at both of us, and he said, then you're going to be a very happy couple. And when the Rebbe said that, I felt like the whole room breathed a sigh of relief. I felt totally relaxed after that. The smile was a smile that lit up the room. And and by the Rebbe saying that, by the way, that you're going to be a very happy couple, you know, Leah and I were, after 36 years, you know, that rings true. The Rebbe answered the first question first that I asked, and the second question second. And he said, in the realm of the compatibility question, he says, we need to have a common goal. He says, my goal, said to me, is to strengthen my wife in Torah and Mitzvahs. Her goal is to strengthen me in Torah and Mitzvahs. And he said, we should learn together. He suggested at that time, because of my lack of background at the time, we should learn Ketzer Shulchan Aruch, he said. And he said he believes that it's in English, we could learn it in English. We should learn together. And he said, then when we take this common goal of fortifying each other, and we have a child, children will be able to communicate and give our go over to the child in turn. And he says all the differences will become dissipated in that common goal.
Mrs. Rachel Fogelman and her husband have been shluchim in Worcester, Massachusetts since 1947.
I would speak, and I organize groups of not women that belong to the yeshiva, women that were outside of the yeshiva, outside of the fringe of our sphere. And I spoke, and they always asked me to do book reviews. And whenever I did a book review, no matter what the book, I always brought in something about Yiddishkeit and used the book review as a vehicle to speak about Torah and Yiddishkeit and to draw them closer. We went in for Yechidus, and the Rebbe just greeted us so beautifully and so warmly. And my husband mentioned to the Rebbe that the following week I was going to speak at the temple, and I was going to do a book review on The Chosen, Chaim Potok. The Rebbe looked at me, and he looked at me in a way that only the Rebbe could look at someone, with a deep perception, with a knowledgeable, otherworldly perception. And he looked and he said, they're going to listen to you. And then the Rebbe said, speak about Taras HaMishpacha. Well, I was taken aback. I would love to speak about Taras HaMishpacha, but this book, The Chosen, is a book about boys, about the relationship of a son and his father. And I thought, how am I going to bring that and speak about Taras HaMishpacha? But the Rebbe said, speak about Taras HaMishpacha. It was no question. That's what I had to do. When I came to the temple that morning that I had to speak, we met in a room downstairs that the temple people used for their small minyanim, if someone had, say, kaddish or whatever. And the room soon filled up. It filled up so quickly that the chairman of the event, the chair lady, said, well, we'll go upstairs to the main sanctuary. Now, the main sanctuary in the temple is a very large, large room. It must hold about 1,000 people. It's huge. And pretty soon, the room began to fill up and fill up more and more until there was standing room in the back and women were standing there. And so I thought, okay, I'm going to do this. And I started out with the book by Chaim Potok. I described the scene, what it meant. And then I mentioned, did you notice that there are no women in this book? Did you notice that the father's wife is not mentioned? The son's mother is not brought to light? And there's no relationship between men and women. The reason there's no relationship in this book, because to touch upon it would require a book in itself. The relationship between men and women in Jewish life is holy and precious, and it is based on Taras HaMishpacha. And I went on from there, and I explained what Taras HaMishpacha was, what it meant to us, and why it was a flaw in the book, and a flaw in most Jewish lives, because people are unaware of it. The audience was electrified. People called me up, women called me up, where is the mikveh that you spoke of? It was an old mikveh on the east side that was used by very few women. It was in such a decrepit old building. So, but we knew we needed a new building, and this started a campaign for a new mikveh building. That was how it began, and ultimately, we built a mikveh here in Worcester. We have to realize that Koiches Pnimiyim, inner strengths that the Eibishter gives us, is what the Rebbe sees in us all the time. And he strengthens us in such a way and directs us in such a way that those Koiches Pnimiyim are brought to a fruition, that they have positive and actual results in reality.
We'll show you the last video, but what is everybody's question? after that video?
I mean, I don't remember when she started, when she mentioned a mikvah at all until she, was that something that I missed?
She mentioned it at the end in the context, that was really the whole, so family purity is about the mikvah, right? So family purity is the idea, which I didn't really mention in the class, that there's a separation between husband and wife while a woman is menstruating, and then they come back together after the woman goes to the mikvah, which also represents this tension and the benefit of the individual and the community, right? There's a time for individualism, and there's a time to come together. When there's a healthy balance between that, that nurtures the family unit. I thought everybody was going to ask me what the Rebbe's answer was about the marijuana. So, because they don't, it doesn't answer it in this video, but he did answer it. Anyway, let's watch the last video.
Then you should become a fiancé.
Name.
But you are also going to be one in the very
same.
Try the Hassan. Try the Hassan. If you need it, the issue is that that's the outcome of the massive need of what you like. That's free of the instruction of the Hassan.
Oh, okay.
It's good, but you don't know how to find the Hassan, is it?
Mary Fashane is kind.
She's a huge thing. Don't get that. Don't get that. Don't get that.
Sooner. That's all she wrote.
I noticed there's a note in the book that Ms. Thea Schuster has a citation.
Is that so?